Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're bringing you some of the messages that you've sent in over the past few weeks. I guess if we don't have any business right here at the top, Rob, do you want to jump right in with this message from Mihao responding to our episodes on the Holy Undead?
Certainly. So Mihao writes, "Hello, Joe and Robert. I hope you're both doing well. I'm writing to you from Poland, where all the trees are now beautifully colored. Winds are getting cold, and nights are longer and longer. I love autumn with its atmosphere that suits horror and folk tales so well. I was very impressed with your two-parter on the Holy Undead, and hearing those tales and stories reminded me of one that circulated around my hometown. I grew up in a reasonably small town in the south of Poland where you have mostly forests, hills, bogs, and meadows. It's rather picturesque, but can also get a bit spooky. My town has a population of 10,000 people, and it's rather old. Oldest written record that mentions it dates back to the 14th century, where it's called by its current name, though in Latin. We have a few local legends around, but one always creeped me out more than the others. You see, my town has two parishes. The older one was established in 1870 and the other around the 1980s. Here comes the twist. It's not the old parish that has a creepy tale attached to it, smiley face, and I assume like sinister smiley face. The church from the 80s for a long time was simply a wooden bungalow with a cross mounted on the roof. It's been that way until the priest that was in charge of it raised enough money to build a new proper temple. He oversaw the construction, and with the money that was left, he ordered a graveyard to be built in the proximity of the church. He was a standout man. I actually met him as a kid. He was harsh and very devoted, but just and good with children. But he also had crippling diabetes, and eventually he died because of it. I will never forget his last Mass, where he mumbled prayers and could barely stand behind the altar. Like I said, he was devoted and wouldn't let anyone talk him out of doing his job as long as he could. Due to reasons unknown to me, he did not consecrate the graveyard that he built. It's widely known across my town that he wanted to, and the fact that he didn't was one of his biggest regrets. So the tale that I wanted to tell you, but I felt compelled to make into an intro to, is that his restless spirit haunted the graveyard, demanding it be consecrated. His body was actually the first one to be laid to the ground over there, which I always found to be quite something. So legend says that if you'd venture into the yard at night, you could have met with the ghost of a priest asking you to do all you can to consecrate the land. The ghost would go on and say that no soul will ever leave the place until it's properly consecrated. Eventually, the new priest came over, and the first thing he did was he went to the graveyard with a bucket of holy water. Smiley face. It must have laid the old priest's spirit to rest, because all the accounts of him haunting the place ended there. I've never seen the ghost, nor went to the cemetery at night, but I know a lot of folks who swear they've seen the apparition. When I was a kid, I believed it without asking any questions. Now, though, I think of it as a creepy and wholesome tale from an otherwise quite boring corner of the world. I hope this email wasn't too long and you found some entertainment reading it. Stay spooky and happy Halloween. Mihao."
Wow. So a thoroughly authentic modern story of the pious undead. This is quite similar to the tales we were talking about in the episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. This is quite a treat.
Though one thing I like in this one is that it's one of those ghost stories that involves the ghost specifically asking the living to do something on behalf of the ghost. I don't think any of the other tales had that, or maybe I'm forgetting one. The other ones were just like, get out of here. This is, it's ghost time now, you know.
Yeah, this ghost nighttime business.
Yeah, exactly. No humans allowed. But this one, it seems to suggest a supernatural set of rules, including the idea that a graveyard that is not yet consecrated is like a prison for ghosts. The spirits cannot leave until it's consecrated, and he needs the new priest to throw the holy water on.
Yeah, this is neat because it also lines up with a lot of modern ghost stories and ghost media where ghost is doing something and it leads to the question, well, what can we do to fix this? Let's fix this.
Yeah.
And I feel like some of the better ghost stories, like say The Ring, subvert this by ultimately the answer being nothing. Like you may think you can reason with the undead, but you cannot. This reminds me a lot of some of the stuff we talked about in the Leshy episode from last year that I believe we recently reran, where we talked about the idea of the wilderness, like the older idea of the wilderness often being one where it's wild out there. Maybe it has rules, but it's not rules you can understand. And we get into a more modern understanding where it's like, oh, we know basically how the wilds work, and we can you know, try and do things to follow those laws or fix things, etc. And I wonder if we see a similar thing here with the idea of the wild world of the spirits.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned the ring. I mean, I think there are a few stories I can think of that are sort of like this, where if there is a logic to the wild world of the spirits and there are rules, there. The extent to which you can grasp the rules and leverage them is only enough to sort of like get you personally out of trouble, not to sort of make everything right.
Right.
Which ultimately is the resolution in the ring, right? It's the, you know, you can't really like fix the problem. You can only sort of help the evil spread, and that'll at least save your skin for the time being.
Right.
All right, this next message comes from Matt. This is on our pair of episodes on the invention of the chainsaw. Matt says, "Good day, fellas. Regarding your Samhain-adjacent chainsaw episodes, which were excellent, I thought you'd be interested to hear about a particularly interesting and potentially deadly chainsaw-slash-logging-related phenomenon known as the barber chair. The name alone falls in line with the seasonal theme, I think. A barber chair refers to a particular result of improperly cutting the front hinge point of a tree, causing unintended pressure in the middle of the trunk elsewhere. I'm not a professional, so please take this description with a large pinch of salt. The result is that the tree splits upwards and falls somewhere overhead of the intended felling notch, and not necessarily in the direction intended. I've seen it happen on smaller trees while cutting trails through the bush. Even small ones can still be dangerous, but I imagine it's quite scary on larger ones. It can also ruin what would otherwise be good lumber. There are many reasons professional arborists warn people about the dangers of an improperly cut hinge. Maybe someday a horror director will utilize the barber's chair on film. Thanks for the episode, Matt." And so, Matt, I had no idea about this. Thank you for letting us know, because I looked this up and it is astonishing and scary. So it is, as Matt describes, in some cases, you can be sawing horizontally into the trunk of a tree. And if the circumstances are right, the tree can start to fall over before you have cut all the way through. And this leads to the trunk splitting vertically. So like part of the trunk peels off of the rest of the trunk and flips up like a hinge or like a trap lever sort of springing up out of nowhere. And I've watched some videos of this happening in real time while people are taping themselves sawing through trees, which I guess is, you have to be lucky enough to be recording the sawing through anyway, which would normally not be something that people would think to film. But it looks really scary when it happens. Suddenly, like the tree starts kind of twisting in a way that isn't expected. And in both of the cases I saw, the sawyer who's working the chainsaw gets out of the way fast enough to not be harmed. But I've also seen illustrations of how loggers could be killed by this. For example, if the hinge that pops up when the trunk splits up the vertical axis, it can basically pop up like a big, a big smacking arm and like hit you in the head and kill you.
Yeah, I hope one of the big takeaways from our chainsaw episodes, and these are, I think, things that either I kind of learned or were, strengthened for me, is that, okay, in our culture, we might think that the chainsaw is kind of our right, you know, that it's like, of course I need a chainsaw, or I should get a chainsaw, or if something needs sawing in my backyard, I should just go get one and I can do this. But regardless of what your decision happens to be on a matter like that, like respect the saw, respect the fact that it is a tool that can potentially be dangerous or put you in a dangerous position. And, you should absolutely take it seriously.
Yeah. The saw and the tree, respect the tree.
Yeah. Because the tree too is one of those things where when the tree is healthy and standing still, as they do most of the time, it's easy to forget like how dangerous they can be if they are suddenly in motion.
Yeah, exactly. And especially in this case, if they're in motion in a way that you didn't expect. So you may be taking proper safety precautions in terms of no one being down line of the tree in the direction that you're expecting it to fall. But if you have one of these barber chair incidents, the tree could be exerting sudden violent force in directions that you did not plan.
Yeah. Now, as for seeing the barber chair in a horror movie, I don't really want to see that. I think if you were to tell me, yes, they've made a chainsaw horror movie and it's about realistic chainsaw injuries and chainsaw-related fatalities, I'd be like, no, that does not sound good. You keep your Final Destination chainsaw movie.
I'm trying to imagine how that would be used in a plot. I mean, like, is there a pivotal tree cutting down scene? Like, is Leatherface chasing somebody and he has to cut down a tree to get to them, but then the barber chair smacks him and defeats him?
I'll tell you what. If someone is heart set on creating a film like this, I'll tell you that Michael Shea wrote a short story, I think it's called Uncle Tugs, that had some chainsaw mishaps in it. And because the plot had to do with like loggers in Northern California, and there was like a grow house and also some sort of vengeful ghost. And I believe the vengeful ghost was causing some accidents to occur. Hmm. And so that would actually be a pretty decent story if someone wanted to find some sort of narrative structure in which to fit a whole bunch of chainsaw accidents.
Well, speaking of chainsaw accidents, the next message that we're going to read also does mention these, so be forewarned.
All right. This is from Kenneth. Hi, Rob and Joe. Excellent episode on the invention and history of the chainsaw. I had been planning to write in a few days ago, but the unexpectedly early birth of our first child put thoughts of an email on the back burner. Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
Kenneth continues, I had a couple of thoughts regarding chainsaws, the first of which was the dramatic and near-fatal experience of a friend's husband. A tree surgeon by trade, he was at work removing heavy overhanging boughs from a large urban oak. The section he was working on was high above the street, so he ascended using a cherry picker, then made his way through the branches and secured himself to the trunk with a harness. Unfortunately, at some point in the tree's long history, something substantial had been secured to the branch. As it grew, it had entirely absorbed a thick steel bolt. Ooh. When his chainsaw reached the hidden metal, it kicked back violently, biting deep into his thigh and nicking the femoral artery. It was only through the quick thinking of his colleague, the speedy arrival of the fire service, and close proximity to a hospital that his life was saved.
Oh, this gets right into something you mentioned in the episodes, that one of the main sources of direct injuries from chainsaws being kickback.
Yeah, and here, yeah, this unseen metal hidden within the tree branch, and yeah, you do see plenty of this in not only in an urban environment, but even in a rural environment. You see trees growing around metal, be it weird. I've certainly seen weird poles positioned near trees and on trees, and you see trees growing in and around fencing. So that's interesting and terrifying. I'm glad it turned out okay.
Yeah, the tree just swallows stuff. So, yes, like Rob said, very glad to hear your friend's husband was all right.
Kenneth continues, my second thought, since the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the Evil Dead were so central to the episode, was about chainsaws as weapons. I know Rob has a bit of a soft spot for Games Workshop models, and it's impossible to talk about Warhammer 40,000 without considering a Space Marine wielding a chainsword. I've included a photograph of a Space Marine apothecary, basically a battlefield medic, bearing one of these weapons. If you look closely at his wrist, you'll notice he's also equipped with a smaller medical chainsaw, though I'm assuming this is for on-the-spot amputations rather than obstetrics.
I'm assuming that the Space Marine apothecary is not strongly informed by real-life medical science.
No. I think if memory serves, one of his primary jobs is to remove the gene seed from a corpse. I don't know. The real lore masters out there will have to tell me if I'm correct on that. So I'm not even sure he's supposed to save lives as much as, like, let's get that important gene thingy out of the dead body. Anyway,
Kenneth continues. Space Marine apothecary does not have a Hippocratic Oath.
Probably not. Kenneth continues, I'm not sure a chainsword would be a particularly effective weapon. You probably couldn't use it like a traditional sword, as parrying and violent striking attacks would cause damage to the mechanism. It would probably have to be brought to bear on vulnerable points without great chopping swings. I do enjoy the idea of the chainsword as a futuristic melee weapon. It's in the vein of the Viroblade lightsaber and monofilament edges of other sci-fi weapons, but is typically over the top, fitting the brutality of the grim dark setting better. It brims with the implication you alluded to, that the weapon itself is hungry, that that only the slightest touch can cause catastrophic damage, even getting away from the user in its eagerness to be about its purpose. It is a brutal weapon, unlike the more civilized lightsaber, even though the latter would be even more devastating. Anyway, thanks for the amazing show. Keep up the great work. Kenneth.
Sounds like Kenneth throwing cold water on my Texas lightsaber massacre idea.
Yeah, well, you know, it would be a lot of clean cuts. That's the thing. As for the chain swords, I actually did have a note about chain swords in the notes for our chainsaw episodes, but then I decided not to say anything about it because I'm like, I don't want to hear anything about Warhammer in this episode. But no, true enough, there are a lot of chain swords in there. I'm not sure. Surely chain swords pop up in other fiction. But this is the main place you see them. And yeah, I don't think they would particularly be practical weapons, even if you try to explain them away with a bunch of, like, you know, high-tech materials and, you know, super well-designed, you know, chain and so forth. But it does fit this sort of this grim, you know, at times overly macho vibe that Warhammer 40,000 has going for it. And probably ties in well to a lot of the, you know, the satire, I think, that was originally intended by the world. But anyway, Kenneth, thanks for writing in, and once more, congrats on the kiddo.
Okay, Rob, you ready for a couple of messages having to do with Weird House Cinema, or at least adjacent to it?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's see. How about this one from Nathan? Nathan says, Hi, Joe, Robert, and Seth. I was recently watching the cinematic masterpiece Christine, not long after re-listening to your episode on The Ship of Theseus, which is one of my favorites. I started wondering about the lore of the movie. And if you're not familiar, this is a movie about, I don't know, a demonic car that a guy has a kind of unhealthy, obsessive relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. If the car had been completely restored, every single part, would it still be so murderous? Or is the car possessed on a deeper level? We're asking the tough questions here. Nathan then says, I also really enjoyed your recent episodes on the invention of the chainsaw. However, I can't believe you didn't mention Paul Bunyan. The 1958 Disney short is a classic, even for someone like me who isn't the biggest Disney fan. Anyway, you guys do a great job, and again, thanks for keeping me entertained on my boring overnight grocery job, Nathan. Well, Nathan, I did not have time to watch the whole short before we started recording here, but I clicked around and saw some moments of it. One of the things that really got me is it starts off by, and I love the animation style, by the way, so it does look great, but it starts off by showing a shadow of the title hero, Paul Bunyan, looming over a map of North America. And I noticed something I thought was really interesting. I was like, wow, they chose to depict Paul Bunyan with long hair that he wears in a bun. And I was like, could that be a choice connected to the name Bunyan? But then I realized I had simply been misled by the silhouette. He's actually wearing some kind of wool cap that has like a pom-pom or a gathered up section on the top. So he doesn't have a bun, but I thought that would have been cool. And I guess, you know, in the broader sense, not that unusual. Tons of kinds of like bun and top knot hairstyles have been common for men in plenty of cultures throughout history. But it would have been interesting to see Paul Bunyan in a cartoon from the 50s with a bun. Alas. Yes.
I vaguely remember this cartoon looking at these stills, but I guess it's not one that I watched a lot, or maybe we didn't have on VHS.
Yeah, I think it's like 17 minutes long. So I don't know what was the venue for showing things like this in the 50s. It's like much shorter than a feature length movie. Would this like play in a movie theater or play like before a feature film? I don't know.
That sounds like a question for our producer, Seth.
What do you know? Reporting from a few minutes later, Seth did have the answer. Seth knows everything about animation. Well, I don't want to put too much pressure on him, but he does often have the answer here. So apparently these shorts were originally compiled into feature films. And so, you know, you'd have Paul Bunyan alongside some other shorts of a similar type, and that would be shown as a feature in theaters. But then later, I guess they were split up and shown in other ways. But also, like I said, I did not have time to watch this whole thing, but skipping around, there is a fun scene where Paul Bunyan walks through a forest and he's just mowing down trees by swinging his axe back and forth like it's a weed eater. And then he walks back over the ground he has cut down, stomping on all of the stumps to sink them down into the earth. And also, Nathan doesn't mention it, but I assume this is part of what he's referring to as saying that this would have been a good thing to fit into our episode on the chainsaw, because there's a part where Paul Bunyan, it looks like he has to compete against a guy who shows up with a steam-powered saw. So it's like war. Yeah, it's the war against the machines. Thou shalt not make a saw in the likeness of man.
Now, as for his Christine question, I don't know. That's always a fun one. At what point, if you were to totally strip the car apart for parts, you know, would those parts make other cars haunted? I don't know.
You could also apply this to a haunted house story. So if you were to tear down the house and rebuild the house in the same spot, is it still haunted? Often I think movies would say yes, just maybe like the ground is haunted. What if you dug up all the ground and moved the earth away? Is it still the geographical coordinates are haunted?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess the idea is there's got to be something that latches onto the idea of the ghost, you know. There's got to be something where there's a forged connection. So if you took the car apart, like the ghost would have to, in a sense, choose the thing that he wanted to continue to haunt. Because as I recall in the book, it's more about like there's a dead dude who haunts the car. And then in the movie, they kind of made the choice to make it be more like the car is alive, which I think I ultimately liked more. but yeah, so like the ghost has to choose, like, what are you going to be? Do you want to be the tires? You want to be probably the steering wheel, you know, or like the engine block? I don't know.
Steering wheel gets a lot of love.
Yeah.
I want to be the hood ornament.
that would be good too. You know, it's very symbolic. All right. Here's another one. This one comes to us from Brian. Hey, Robert and Joe, I'm a longtime fan of your podcasts. And after hearing Rob mention that he watched Black Sabbath on AMC Plus, I signed up for a trial, which led me to then watching House by the Cemetery. I was obviously pretty excited that you chose it for your next episode of Weird House Cinema. While you both did a great job of describing the surreal weirdness of that movie, I assume he means House by the Cemetery, I believe you left out mentioning two incidents that were so jarring to my girlfriend and me that we had to rewind just to confirm we hadn't misunderstood them. The first was that despite Norman and his family having had no previous relationship to the titular house, there was a quite large photo of that very house in their apartment in Manhattan. Yep. It's the one Bob is looking at while his mother packs in the beginning. It is rare for a family to have a 12x12 photo of a house they've never seen before hanging in their living room and then subsequently move into that house and never once address it.
Yeah. And also that photo has Bob explicitly tells his mother that the photo was talking to him and she seems uninterested in this fact.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way to answer this question in a way that makes sense. Like no matter like what sort of mental hoops you jump through to try and make it work, it just gets more confusing. But Brian continues. The second was when the realtor says to Norman, as they are arranging to rent the house, quote, "Of course, you've been there before, haven't you, Dr. Boyle?" Norman gets a guilty look on his face while Lucy gives him a suspicious eye. He half-heartedly denies the allegation and moves on. We took the meaning of this to be that Dr. Boyle had sexual trysts in the home like his former colleague, and the realtor was accidentally exposing this in front of his wife. We were laughing pretty hard because what sort of realtor says, "I believe you've had an affair in this home, no?" to his prospective client. Who knows? It's never addressed again. Just thought you might enjoy knowing that the movie made even less sense than you had already believed.
Wow. I did not even notice that second one.
I remember the second one. I didn't even think about the idea of it being like an affair situation. I was just confused by it. Like, because they're like, "You've been there before, right? You came with your daughter." Because this was another thing. He said, "You came here with your daughter, right?" And he's like, "No, I have a son So yeah. I was thinking it had something to do with the ghosts and the idea that, like, not only are they like another family to come to the house, but they're kind of like an echo of the family that had been there previously. Like the yeah. house attracts a certain type.
You've always been the caretaker here. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of thing. I guess that may indeed be the true origin, is like looking to sort of, you know, inspiration from other films that Fulci might have been looking at. But mm-hmm. I guess I'll stand by what I said earlier. If there's something that doesn't make sense in a Fulci movie, very little is going to be revealed by trying. You can't make it make sense.
Like, right.
The nonsense is yeah. like baked into the DNA of the thing.
I think another way to put that is, a lot of times I don't even get the feeling that Fulci is trying to make it make sense and failing. He's just not even trying.
Right. Yeah. Like, and so it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes, because in other movies, you can go through that mental exercise and you can, like, I can make it make sense because the creator was trying to make something make sense. But not necessarily the case with Fulci. Oh, and here we have another little bit from Brian. He has a PS attached. Quote, an ad for J&B Scotch on a New York City bus in the beginning of the movie reminded me of what a staple it is in Giallo films. I feel like y'all could run up a pretty high count of all the J&B bottles or ads you see in Weird House Cinema movies. Just a thought. And then he includes a link that is jandbinthemovies.com and says, loving the episodes. Thanks, Brian.
Have we not talked about this on the show before? I know that this is something I've talked about a lot, but maybe not on mic. So J&B is in every Italian horror movie. There's almost always a bottle that shows up somewhere. Rachel and I point these out to each other every time when we watch a Giallo movie or just any Italian horror movie. I can scarcely remember having watched one where a J&B bottle doesn't appear at some point.
This might have been off mic, but I remember this popping up with Return of the Blind Dead, because yeah. there's the scene where they're all going to, the new fireworks man is in town, they're going to all have a drink. And I was thinking, oh, well, I'm kind of interested in what are they going to drink? Is it something, you know, something kind of Spanish or something, you know, that's going to be really fitting of the location or where it's supposed to take place?
A nice Spanish sherry or something.
Yeah, but it wasn't. It was J&B, right? Yeah. I seem to recall J&B.
Well, no, actually, I wonder if that might have come up because I was expecting it to be J&B, and then it wasn't.
It wasn't. Oh, okay.
But Brian, in any case, you are absolutely correct. There, almost every Italian horror movie I've ever seen has J&B in it. I don't know why that is. I don't know if they had like their national film board had a like ad relationship or something, or maybe it was just a perfectly spontaneous replication phenomenon. I really don't know.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I think Return of the Living Dead just had some sort of, I think maybe it was British whiskey of some sort.
Okay. Return of the Blind Dead. Yeah.
Yeah. Return of the Blind Dead. So it was, it was not Spanish. It was something less exciting. I mean, nothing against J&B, but.
No thoughts one way or another, really. But if somebody out there is like an Italian film historian who wants to tell us why J&B is in all these movies, I would love to know.
But that website is pretty amusing because it is just movie after movie, and like you can see, oh, there it is. There's J&B in the background. All right, there's a bottle on the table. Yep, they're pouring some J&B in that scene.
Oh, man, one of the top entries on the blog right now is Beyond the Door. That's one that I know has come up on Weird House Cinema before. That's the Italian Exorcist ripoff where they're discussing baby names and a lady quite hilariously goes, what about Steve? No knock on people named Steve, but I don't know. It's funny.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close the mailbag for today. But hey, certainly keep the Halloween-related listener mails coming in. We'll continue to address those, obviously. And so just write in with thoughts on past episodes, current episodes, potential future episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, the core episodes of our Friday Weird House Cinema episodes, anything related to the artifacts on Wednesday, or just, you know, other listener mails that we read on Mondays.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.